This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Before I introduce our guest speaker tonight, I just wanted to say that last month, the Wall Street Journal ran a major article entitled Gene Breakthroughs Spark a Revolution in Cancer Treatment. And this article goes on to describe patients who responded to the new targeted therapies, which home in on the genetic abnormalities of the tumors that are driving the proliferation and growth of the tumor cells and the metastasis. And the next speaker in the series will be Rizal Kurzrock, who will actually detail about how she thinks we can win the war against cancer, on cancer with a more personalized approach to therapy. But there are enormous regulatory, social, and reimbursement challenges that we will discuss in this series in the months ahead. So there's lots of excitement about how we may be able to convert cancer from a disease that metastasizes and kills you to a chronic condition that you can live with that is controlled by a cocktail of targeted agents that are unique to the individual tumor genomic signature. This, in many ways, is how AIDS is controlled today with a cocktail of drugs that has converted a lethal disease into a manageable disease. In addition, the genetic abnormalities that we see in cancers has led to a resurgence in the control of the disease by the immune system, which can target the proteins produced by these genetic abnormalities, because the proteins are abnormal, the peptides are abnormal, and these result from the genetic changes that result inside the cancer cell, and the immune system can recognize those. So I agree with the article that we are on the brink of a major revolution in cancer treatment, especially when you consider that in 2015, 2 years from now, a company here in San Diego, Illumina, we'll charge only $500 to sequence all 23,000 genes in a tumor cell. That's less than the charge for an MRI. And so I think it's easy to predict that the practice of oncology will dramatically change in the years ahead, starting in 2015. So now the question is, do we have the current cancer research establishment, with the current cancer research establishment, do we have the appropriate infrastructure in terms of carrying out what needs to be done, and that is why we've invited Clifton Leaf to speak to us today. We're so pleased that Cliff Leaf will be kicking off our speaker series. And as Mary said, and just to correct you, the series is entitled, Mary, you didn't say this, Overthrowing the Emperor of All Maladies. That's what this is all about. And based, on, of course, on Mukherjee's book titled The Emperor of All Maladies, as Mary had just said. Today's featured speaker, Clifton Leaf, is a renowned journalist, editor, author, and a cancer survivor himself. He had Hodgkin's lymphoma when he was a younger man, and I'm pretty sure he's cured today. But this experience with cancer did sensitize him to looking at the existing cancer research enterprise and the notion that it needs revamping. Clifton Leaf has a Master's of Fine Arts from Sarah Lawrence College, so he's not a physician. I'm sure he'll be the first to tell you that. But he just published a brand new book that just came out, which is titled Truth in Small Doses, Why We Are Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It. In 2004, he jolted the cancer research establishment with his cover story in Fortune magazine, which was titled Why We're Losing the War on Cancer. And after that, he decided to delve into this issue in much more detail, which led to the publication of his book this year, nearly a decade later. It should be noted that this Fortune magazine cover story earned Clifton Leaf the Henry Luce Award for Public Service. Recently, Cliff has been a guest editor of the New York Times op-ed section and Sunday Review. He has served as executive editor of Fortune magazine, as well as the Wall Street Journal Smart Money magazine. And I found a very interesting another accolade that he received, that Cliff was invited to give grand rounds at the National Cancer Institute. I've given grand rounds before. Grand rounds are reserved for physicians. You don't have non-physicians giving grand rounds, but Cliff Leaf was invited to give grand rounds at the National Cancer Institute after he wrote that article. This was the only time in the history of the National Cancer Institute that a journalist was invited to give grand rounds. So, in 2006, Cliff was honored with the Time Warner's highest recognition for community service. It's called the Andrew High School Award. And now we are honored to have him with us today. So please join me in welcoming Clifton Leaf, who will have provocative thoughts, I'm sure, on the cancer research enterprise here in the United States and ideas on how to make it better. Cliff.
It's really a pleasure to be here, and I'll get right to a story, as I think this is an important story. The year was 1957. Dennis Parsons Burkitt, the guy on the left, had been in Uganda for 10 years, most of that time in the rolling hill city of Kampala, which was the capital of the Buganda Kingdom and had become the capital of the new British colony there. He was the chief surgeon of one of the three surgical wards at the Mugala Hospital. But he was by no means a great surgeon. By his own estimation, he was a decent surgeon, a bush surgeon. Maybe he would have had more time for artistry if there weren't so many patients. But there was nothing but patients, especially in children. Parents would bring their children with their bodies bent from polio and wilted from hunger and ulcerated from infection and gouged out by animal bites. There was no shortage of plagues in Uganda, or in East Africa for that matter. Malaria, sleeping sickness, onion fever, bilharzia, yaws, terrible, terrible diseases, kwashiorkor. And for the first time, when he was first in Uganda, in a northern city called Lira, he was responsible for a district that was 7,000 miles, have a 250,000 population, and he would drive around in this Ford pickup with no brakes and pull into what were grandly called sub-dispensaries, which were just huts, and do surgery after surgery. In his first year there, he did about 600 surgeries, he had estimated. This would have been a grueling pace for anybody, for a doctor just fresh out of medical school. But Burkitt, by then, was 46 years old. He had three kids. His wife, pictured there, had been in and out of good health. Most of that time she'd been ailing in Uganda. And there was one other thing. What was the one other? Oh, yeah, he was missing an eye. So at the age of 11, in his preparatory school outside in the yard in Northern Ireland, some boys had been getting into a fight, and poor Burkitt had gotten caught in the melee, and someone threw a rock and it hit him in his eyeglasses, and the shards went into his eye, into his right eye, and three different surgeries later, he was left with a glass eye. So it had been a hard press to get the British Medical Research Council to allow a one-eyed surgeon into their ranks, but he was relentless. He was this wonderful, fast-talking Irishman with a high-pitched voice, and he would just great lilt, and he would just push talk and talk and talk until he got his way oftentimes. And that was the case with the Medical Research Council. Plus, they were desperately in need of surgeons, as I just said. Well, with his one eye, he definitely had lacked in depth perception. And yet, there were some things that the Irish surgeon could see that no one else could see. And yet, nothing on earth, nothing he had ever seen in Africa prepared him for this. The boy's name was Africa. He was 5 years old. And when his parents brought him into the Mugalo Hospital, Burkitt didn't even know how to react. There were tumors in his mandible and his maxilla, two separate bones. It was as if a forest fire had leapt over a forest wall, a firewall. The teeth had been pushed out of their moorings. He didn't know what this was. Was it a fast-growing cancer or what? He examined the boy. He did some x-rays. He found that there were tumors in the rest of his abdomen. He didn't quite know what to make of it, But he also knew there was nothing he could do. There was no way to cut anything out. There were too many tumors. And he knew the boy would die in a few days. And the boy did. Burkett was really struck. He took some photographs like he always did. He took photographs of everything. He would develop them in his tub. And so the next day, he thought about this more. And a couple of weeks later, he was giving medical rounds in a town called Lira, which is about 60 miles away. This was the home of the great Nile River, some said. He was looking out the window when he saw another child, very similar, with the same jaw tumors protruding. He was like, could this be a new infectious disease? What was going on? He'd never seen anything like that. He had been 10 years in Uganda and had never seen anything like it. And now, in a three-week span, was seeing two children, two little boys with identical seeming tumors. He ran outside and begged the mom to take the boy with him back to the hospital. And they drove him back in their truck. And they took x-rays again and saw that there were tumors everywhere. He photographed them. Sometimes his daughters would go and look to see what daddy was cooking in the tub when he would develop it. And they were shocked to find these images. They just looked unreal. Burkett, where was this coming from? He started asking around, has anyone seen these tumors? Now, the Kampala, the hospital, the Malaga Hospital in Kampala had pretty good records, but the best records were in the Mengo Hospital, which had been started by Albert Cook, who was a missionary, in 1897 or something. And so he went to the Mengo Hospital, and there, in Albert Cook's records that were in the basement, he had written about these jaw tumors and had actually done some drawings and said that sarcomas of the jaw, he thought they were sarcomas, were particularly common in Ugandan children. So here it was. Albert Cook is saying that these are common tumors and Burkett had never seen it before. So he thought, well, maybe these tumors had manifested in some different way. Maybe, you know, the way doctors had classified tumors, they would classify by where the primary was. So if it was in the eye, they might call it a retinoblastoma. If it was in the kidney, a Wilms tumor. If it was in the chest, you know, they might call it something else. And so this diagnostic framework had perhaps hidden, had obfuscated a tumor that other people had seen. He asked around. Burkett always asked everything. He would ask everybody everything. And he said, have you seen this tumor? Have you seen this tumor? And he'd show his pictures. Now he was armed with his pictures. And sure enough, lots of children were showing up, and he was photographing them. Now, he did a series of conversations with local hospital directors and doctors until finally he had discovered that perhaps this tumor was one of the most common childhood cancers in Uganda, and yet he had never seen it. So he sent off a paper to the British Journal of Surgery, a sarcoma involving the jaws in African children, and it got zero reaction. Nobody really paid attention to it. It was just some guy saying that he had found 38 patients with this sarcoma of the jaw in a short time. Well, Burkett had decided, well, maybe I'll just send a questionnaire out. So he printed up 1,200 flyers with three photographs. I'm sorry for these disturbing images. But three photographs of children, and he sent out that flyer to every hospital and clinic in Africa that he had. He carefully compiled the register of all the names and sent them out and applied for his first research grant, $15. That's how much it was. And he was £15. It was about $40. And soon, after about 3 years or so, answers would trickle in. Yeah, I've seen this tumor. And so he would take little push pins and put them on a map. Now Burkett had three maps in his office. One was of Uganda, one was of East Africa, and one was of all of Africa. And he would put the different colored push pins, meaning if there had been a confirmed case or somebody had suspected a case, and he put them in, and he couldn't afford to actually get colored push pins. So he hand-painted mapping pins himself. He was down to the petty frugal, this guy. He was kind of like a, a Sunday school teacher. His kids used to joke that he would take baths in an inch full of water and complain about the waste. Well, after 3 years, you started to get a lot of pins on the board, and there were patterns emerging. He started to break them down by age and do a little distribution of the disease, trying to see any kind of pattern. No one under than 2 had gotten the disease, and between 4 and 7 it seemed to ramp up, and then no one over the age of 10 seemed to get this horrible disease. Twice as many boys as girls got that. But again, these were just sort of patterns. He couldn't figure out why there was this pattern. So at one point, when he's asking all these questions, a man named George Etley, a doctor from South Africa, a young hotshot, 36-year-old guy, had been giving lectures. Burkitt shows him the pictures, and Dr. Etley goes, "This tumor does not happen in South Africa." And stops. She's like, "Well, it doesn't happen." He said it with absolute certainty. Burkitt goes, "Well, if it doesn't happen in South Africa, I wonder where the edge is." So he thought, what if he were to do a biopsy, but not do a traditional tumor biopsy, but a geographical biopsy? Instead of sampling actual cells out of a tumor, he would sample memories. Because he figured, even though he had sent his questionnaire and even though he'd gotten very good response, epidemiology was pretty tough. It was hard to do by postal carrier. He really wanted to see if he could get people to remember. And if you talk to people, if you get right in front of them and you ask them questions, sometimes they remember things that were important, including where the children had come from. Because again, there weren't hospitals everywhere in Africa. So a lot of parents would trundle their kids in from hundreds of miles away into hospitals. So it was really important, he found out. And he had sort of had a notion of what he wanted to do before he had figured out how to do it. Finally, he decides he's going to do this journey, and he calls his friend Ted Williams. Now, Ted was his oldest friend in Africa. He was a missionary doctor, a great doctor, but he had a skill for a doctor that few people had, which was he could change the front-end bearing while you were having a cup of coffee. He was a very, very great mechanic, and they had figured out that they were going to go on this long 10,000-mile journey through Africa, 30 countries. They had 56 hospitals, in each case asking everybody there whether they had ever seen this tumor. And so they started, and this is the journey. You can see, I don't have a pointer, but if you'll see this little path on the right here, oops, and this is where they went. They started all the way down to Johannesburg and came back up the other side. Looking for any. And in this 10-week journey, they had managed to find more than 200 examples of these tumors. And they were emerging in a pattern, like as if it was a belt going across. And the belt seemed very meaningful, but they didn't know why. Again, it would happen in some countries, but not in others. It would happen in some elevations, but not in others. Some villages, but just outside the village, not in the others. And so when they were traveling, he wrote this up, Tumor Savari in East Africa, and now he's starting to get some notice. And people, the more people hear about it, the more people send him information about this. And the more people were talking about it. And as they were in the car driving through these hot, dusty paths, they were like roads, but they weren't really roads. They were like, first of all, he had this a Ford station wagon that had been brought up by another missionary fleeing the civil war in Congo. And it was a 35-horsepower car with 45,000 miles on it. And often it was so dusty that if they opened the window, they would choke on dust. If they closed it, they would bake. Sometimes there'd be these torrential downpours that would wash out a road. And this is how they sat and passed the time talking about these things. And at one point, it was this talking that was so important, because if they'd flown to all these places, they would have missed it. But in talking, someone had mentioned that, well, maybe this isn't a pattern of geography. Maybe it's a pattern of topography. Maybe altitude has something to do with it. And sure enough, there was this very interesting relationship. It wasn't just altitude, though. Alexander Haddo, an entomologist. There was also another Alexander Haddo, who was a famous chemotherapist at the time. But this guy was an insect guy. And he said, you know, he's looking at this. And it's like, if you look at this, this pattern of where the map of these diseases is anywhere where there was, you know, more than 50 centimeters of rainfall a year and the temperature rarely dipped below 60 degrees, that's really where you're seeing this stuff. So it's not just altitude, but it's also rain and whatnot. And so they looked at this belt that seemed to start about 15 to 18 degrees north of the equator on the north side. On the bottom, it was a little harder to tell. And when he was saying, when Alexander Haddo mentioned this, he says, you know, it kind of reminds me of a sleeping sickness outbreak. I remember seeing a map, and that was carried by the tsetse fly. Somebody else had suggested the Anopheles mosquito in its infinite payload, and sure enough, a map of malaria in sub-Saharan Africa was really a map of Burkitt's lymphoma. An extraordinary finding that just would never have been realized if they hadn't put these pins down on paper. Now, this was only part of the puzzle. In 1961, Burkitt had gone to London. He used to, every couple of years, he would go give these crazy speeches in London talking about these tropical illnesses that he found. One of them was, you know, elephantiasis. Another was hydrocele, which were these terrible diseases where testicular sacs would fill up with fluid. And sometimes he would talk about these crazy things. And so every once in a while, the Bush surgeon would come and there'd be some interest. He was scheduled to give this talk in a giant hall that fit like 1,200 people in it, and 12 people showed up. Now, the next day, he had to give another talk, and it was a little difficult for him to do it. And he made a little joke about it, and in his high-pitched lilt, he started talking about this disease. And one of the guys that was there was this one, named Tony Epstein. Now, Epstein didn't know why he plucked the flyer off the wall, but he did. Plucked it off and he came. And as he's listening, 10 minutes into this conversation, he says to himself, wait a minute. Lots of people have been talking about cancers that were somehow connected to viruses. And there was all this talk of tumor viruses ever since Peyton Roos in 1911 had discovered that a chicken cancer could be passed from one fowl to another by taking this blood from the infected tumor, from the tumor, and grinding it up in a filter so that no particle larger than a virus could ever get through there and then transmitting that cancer. And he had managed to do this to great acclaim and also great skepticism. And ever since then, lots of people had been trying to find these connections between viruses and cancer. And it wasn't that cancer worked like a virus. There were no like outbreaks. Even in the same village, it was rare if more than one child got Burkitt's lymphoma, for example. I mean, brothers and sisters of people with Burkitt's didn't get that, and caretakers didn't get it. So it didn't work like, say, polio or sleeping sickness or some other virus. But there was this way in which somehow that virus transformed the cancer cell. And after the lecture, Epstein invited Burkitt to tea, and he said, would it be okay if perhaps you sent me some tumor samples? Burkitt said, of course. Now, this was not an easy thing to do in the early 1960s. You had to go to freeze, first of all, you had to get the specimens and freeze them in these either dry ice or wet ice, quickly rush it to the airport, and there was one flight a week, and then that flight would come over the next morning, and Tony Epstein would be there at the airport rushing it back to his lab. And this sample after sample were sent, 24 tumor samples, which he would look, trying to make a cell line out of these, a cell line which you could take the immortalized cancer cells and somehow propagate them over time. And it was very, very hard to do. So in the 24th attempt, there was a flight that had been delayed, and the package of tumors was in a cloudy mix of fluid. And he thought, oh, this is ruined. Bacteria got in, and this is over. But he looked at it under the electron microscope and spied something remarkable. He spied this. Now, later, this would be named Epstein-Barr virus. And this was the first time it had come out of a Burkitt's lymphoma cell line. And Tony Epstein started more collaborations. Now, he was trying to find this. He partnered with Bert A. Chung and Yvonne Barr at first, but he needed other eyes. So he contacted the Henleys, Werner and Gertrude Henley at the Philadelphia Hospital, the CHOP, and they were brought into this. And Everett Koop had introduced them to Burkitt. And Eva and George Klein were looking at this in a different way, and the partnerships were sprawling all over the world. Lots of different virus hunters and people interested in the Karolinska Institute and out all across the United States. Until finally, they noticed that, well, it was just in one cell after another, Burkitt's, they would find these EBV positive, Epstein-Barr positive cell, virus titers, and they were in the nucleus. That was somehow meaningful, and they looked like they were clones of each other. But yet, they were finding EBV everywhere. Suddenly, 90% of the population seemed to have antibodies to EBV. So the question was, very few, and even malaria was epidemic. So the question was, how are these two things working together? And this was a great mystery in the 1960s. But how were they working together, these two viral cofactor, a viral and a parasitic cofactor, how were they working to transform a cancer cell? And people started talking about this like it was the Rosetta Stone. Now, you know about the Rosetta Stone? It was this stone from the second century BC, where there were three scripts. And on the bottom was ancient Greek, and then Demotic Egyptian, and then hieroglyphs. And by translating the bottom, you could decipher the second script, the middle script, and by deciphering the middle script, you could finally understand what the boy Pharaoh was saying. And so this was the notion that Burkitt's lymphoma and somehow these connections with these other cofactors were the Rosetta Stone. And it was an exciting time, really. But Burkitt was really interested in something else. He was interested in curing these children. Now another partnership started. Joe Birkenau of the Sloan Kettering Institute had been one of the early chemotherapists. And he had come over and he started talking about methotrexate, this amazing drug that blocked the B vitamin folate from cancer cells, from all cells, actually. And so, but cancer cells needed them because they were furiously dividing. So by stopping this division, it was killing the cancer cells. And so that was a race against time. And so Burkitt, of course, begged and borrowed some. And he said, how did you do it? And he tried it. And at first, he got a remission in a child, and then it came back. He tried cyclophosphamide. He tried everything there was, essentially, begging and borrowing. Now, these were not clinical trials. These children were dying in 3 to 6 weeks. There was no time to set up a clinical trial. And there was no culture about setting up clinical trials in that time. I mean, Sidney Farber had started early in childhood leukemia and had really taken risks that today we would put him in jail for. And this was the culture back then. But right or wrong, he was doing it, and he gave this child a cocktail of poisons. That's what these cytotoxic drugs were. And this is what happened. Amazing. Same child. Now, Peter Clifford, another doctor, another partner, learned some of these techniques and tried it on 15 children, and these children were all cured of Burkitt's lymphoma, all to long-term remissions, most of them all cured. It was remarkable how quickly it had happened. From 1957 to 1966, that's the time frame I just showed you, 9 years. The who, what, when, and where had been answered, and all that remained were the how and the why. In the next 16 years, some clues to the how had happened. So I remember I talked about these two cofactors, the malaria and the EBV. Well, it turns out they worked together to do something that was remarkable. They caused a translocation in two chromosomes. So a little bit of DNA from one chromosome, chromosome 8, swapped with chromosome 14. And this was a familiar process in blood cancers, lymphomas and leukemias. And we see it a lot. We see it in CML, the leukemia that Gleevec works so remarkably against. And people like Janet Rowley in Chicago were working feverishly to find these translocations. And here, Carlo Croce's group had figured out that when this little bit from 8 went to little bit of 14, they created a monster protein called MYC. And MYC was an oncogene. It sent the cell into a replicative loop. And in fact, MYC has been studied enormously and seems to have effects in all sorts of aspects of the cell cycle. But this is what seemed to happen. And so now people were talking even more grandly about the Rosetta Stone. Well, what happened since? So there was this great, great promise. Well, the 31 years since, there's where we are. Burkitt's lymphoma is only a little bit better understood in these 31 years. It's hard to say what happened exactly. Sometimes diseases get excited, you know, there's some excitement over it and people rush in to study it. But after a while, it got a little frustrating and Burkitt had moved on to study, to talk about fiber and other things in diet. And some of the other people had died and moved on. And so there really wasn't much discovered beyond that. It's still an incredibly common. It's endemic in Africa. Now, there is a different kind of Burkitt's, sporadic Burkitt's, that was found also in AIDS patients, that AIDS patients seem to develop. But endemic Burkitt's lymphoma, EB endemic Burkitt's, is still a plague in Africa. In some places, I think one in five cancer cases are there. In Malawi, for example, I think it may be as many as 4 in 10. The cost, even though most of the drugs that we're used to treat are 40 or 50 or 60 years old in some cases, the cost, at least these are 2001 figures from one study, is $2,800 for the typical. That's more than three times the annual family income of the patient, of a person in the Ivory Coast. And I'm sorry, those are old figures. And so the question is, what happened, you know? What changed between then and now? And so I have spent the past 10 years trying to figure that out. What's happened between then and now? And I think that we can't talk about a lot of them, but maybe let's look at this because this is such a great example of sharing of data. So let's talk about this issue of sharing of data. And I've made this little terrible slide here. I'm sorry my artistry is so bad. I was frantically doing this today because I knew I'd have to hand over my flash drive. And there's also, you'll see, a little Nature Journal bias here. but it was so easy to find these kinds of stories about, you know, scientists asking themselves, this isn't Cliff Leaf, you know, some journalist, you know, muckraker saying, this is scientists themselves saying, why won't you people share? This is a very, very different culture from the one that Burkitt had imagined. Genuine global collaborations. And I am not talking about what we normally do. Here's what we normally do. So we have a slow motion collaborative process in which people read each other's papers, or some of them. So you wait a long, long time until something's published, and then you read it. And what we do is, imagine, if you will, that it's a giant jigsaw puzzle on a table. And rather than all these people sitting around the same table working together to figure out, oh, look, well, let's put this together in there, they're taking their own jigsaw and going back to their room and studying that little jigsaw as best they can. And so that's what we have here. So these are data as of today in PubMed. On this one type of cancer gene or protein, depending on which you're looking at, BCL2, there are 44,000 published papers on the ROS gene or protein, KROS and all sorts of the ROS-ROF family and the ROS pathway, 50,249 papers as of in PubMed. TGF-beta, more than 61,000. P53, the great tumor suppressor that is implicated in half of cancers, perhaps. Nearly 69,000 papers have been published. Now, Sir David Lane gave this great talk at the Cold Spring Lab a couple of years ago, and he said, you know, imagine, you know, that just conservatively, that each of these papers costs either taxpayers or the institutions that are running on them, or people, about $100,000 each. Because that's really what you're talking about, that if you think about the time and the grant money that goes into these things, about $100,000. So we'd spent essentially $6.8 billion on P53, and we still had a surprisingly incomplete understanding of its workings, and no effective P53-based therapies, and you could say that about all of these things. And so the question was, did we need a different kind of sharing? Now, I submit that we have unlearned some of the lessons of the long safari. When Dennis Burkitt is remembered, he's mostly remembered for this issue about fiber. He talked a lot about diet and the relationship between the human diet and cancer development. And that's a very important lesson that he's known for. But the long safari we forget about. And so I think that he would ask WWBD, or what would Burkitt do? What would Burkitt ask now? So what now? And I'm just going to end with just two thoughts. We need a culture makeover. That's what I think. And I don't want to get into the specifics about these things, but I would like to talk about two specific areas. This frenzy of grantmanship and publication, and how do we turn that into true collaborations? And the second is this academic caution that's just steeped in the system. And I don't mean just that we should give drugs willy-nilly to people, but the way we think about the science we do and the way grant applications are designed almost to squeegee the innovation out of the process. And I write in depth about that in the book, and so I don't want to just trot out a bunch of statistics, but I think we have to turn that into some medical urgency, to understand, as Burkitt did, that people are dying and that the burden of cancer is getting heavier each year. So when we began this war in 1971, we had about 370,000 or so dying. We now have 580,000. Now, we have a lot larger population, 100 million more people. In heart disease, though, we see a different pattern. So in 2010, there were actually 138,000 fewer deaths from heart disease than there were in 1970. Imagine that, 138,000 fewer deaths, even though we have 100 million more people in the world and running to the Department of Motor Vehicles and sitting through angry meetings and getting yelled at by their bosses and all these things that you would think would stress-induce, you know, and watching Homeland, you know, and yet fewer heart attacks. Same with stroke. Same with virtually everything that you can look at in terms of chronic diseases. It's except for diabetes. But if you take everything other than cancer and just look at the crude death rate has fallen since in the past four decades about everything except cancer, 24%. But with cancer, it's actually gone up 14%, the crude death rate. Now, I submit that the problem is so big that we've forgotten to be scared about it. We've forgotten the urgency. And that's why it's good to see those images. And with that, I just leave you with this hopeful note that I think we can do it. I think that we can change the culture, and hopefully more lives will be saved as a result. Thank you all very much.
Now, I know in the book, Cliff, you went into great detail about what's broken in our cancer research enterprise, if you will. So I guess we're going to have to, the audience members are going to have to buy the book and readily available to and read about it. But there is a lot broken. I agree with you. We stifle innovation. If you have a great new idea, it's hard to get a grant. The people who get grants are the people who've already done the experiment.
Yeah.
And they know how it's going to work out. So what can we do to, is there anything that we can do as people to make the system work better?
Yeah, I think there's a lot we can do. I mean, one of the issues, I think, is that, you know, when I first started to write about these issues in 2004, I was amazed that the biggest sort of welcoming that I got in terms of not necessarily agreement, but welcome, let's start the conversation, was with people in the scientific community, with researchers and doctors and people who said, listen, I completely disagree with you on X, Y, and Z, but you got a point on A, you know, and let's talk about that. And I was just talking with someone before from the Burnham, and we were talking about John Mendelsohn, who was great. He's a San Diego.
My boss.
Right there, yeah. Now, when the piece first came out, there was some circling in the wagons. I'm not going to name names, but John Mendelsohn wrote me this letter, and it was it was a detailed, 11-page letter, and, each one about what I'd gotten wrong, and this and that and that, and what I'd gotten right. And then there was a conversation, let's keep talking about this. And he came into New York, and we talked about it, and we spent, we've had this conversation for basically 10 years. And the engagement, I think, has really, I've seen that from many people. And so my feeling is, and I have seen little changes along the way in terms of having these kind of conversation. So I think just talking about it is useful.
Great. Listen, I want to invite you all to ask questions. If you don't have questions, I'll continue to ask questions. But if you do have a question, I want you to go to the microphone on each side here and identify yourself, because you are being televised. And we want everybody to know who you are. And I know who this is. This is Dr. Robert Engler.
Hi. Academic medicine has something to do with the whole system of academic medicine. We get rewarded for publishing papers ourselves that we get credit for. We get rewarded for getting research grants that we have to be sure no one else knows what's in our grant, or they're going to submit our new idea. And we get academic promotion credit and financial reward for those things. And it seems to me that that would be very... very much preventing people from sharing information, open exchange of ideas, get a new idea, share it with everybody, and see if they can bounce something back to you.
Yeah. All I can say is I'm glad my wife isn't here, because if she was, she would say, why'd you spend 10 years writing a book when you could just say it that fast? basically, that's it. That's the problem right there. Our academic system is built around this dysfunction, and so if you imagine it as an economic system in which every incentive is supposed to create a goal, the incentives, the day-to-day incentives, are misaligned with the goal. So if the aim is to collaborate, the incentive is to discollaborate, as you said. If the aim is to share, the incentive is to hoard, and to be secretive, and to patent aggressively, and to guard your little corner of the pie. So I think that part of the challenge is for us to sort of reimagine what the academic research enterprise looks like. And that's where the hardest part of the problem is. And I think we could have a long conversation about the best way to do that. But I agree.
There's another issue that comes up from the same root cause, perhaps. We're seeing an enormous amount of fraud in science.
Yeah.
And I think the same root cause is there. Is that people have to get those papers published, and so they are fudging. And
yeah,
there's an academic. I want to say it's almost an epidemic of that going on as well. I think they're both the same root cause.
Yeah, I do. I agree. That's
thank you, Bob. Yeah. I'm going to ask you a question, Cliff. Some people have said that they read your paper and your article. And I remember when it came out myself, quite surprised me, but it was very, very interesting. And people have read that nearly 10 years ago, and they read your book today, and people say, well, nothing really has changed. You've implied that, you inferred that today. But let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. We're now in this era of genomic medicine, some people call it post-genomic medicine. Aren't we winning, don't you think we're winning a few more battles? We may not be winning the war. What about, aren't we winning more battles?
It's a really good question. And, I think that we are winning a lot of scientific battles. And so the question is this a problem of science? Now, that seems like a crazy thing to say. Cancer is a complex biological puzzle, and we're filled with a room full of scientists, and we're going at it in a scientific way. But the other challenge that we have is that we have a disease that is also a burden. And so if you think of what the elements of the burden are, more people are getting the disease, and a lot of those people we're overdiagnosing and overtreating because we can't distinguish between those diseases that will truly progress and be aggressive and those that won't. And we're also getting more people who are dying and spending more money treating them. And so to some extent, we're having an incremental gain. But I worry about the model about creating the sort of paradise of chronic disease in which things are managed, because it's very, very expensive and it's very, very difficult to come up with the targeted medicines that will be unique to each person's cancer. I mean, if you talk about the vast heterogeneity of this disease, and Bert Vogelstein has a new paper out or recently just detailing that, it's staggering. And so I worry that in some ways we have some scientific breakthroughs and it becomes like a one-armed bandit, where you win a little bit with the slot machine and you see you start to get some currency back and you say, oh, this is the strategy. I worry that it's going to get us further into the to a rising burden of cancer. So,
as I mentioned, Cliff, a couple of years from now, you know, I think every patient's cancer will be sequenced.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got a company right here for $500. Jay Flatley, the CEO of Illumina, says we're going to do all 23,000 genes. And they're, one of our future speakers is going to be here, Patrick Soon-Shiong. He's going to tell you, I can, and I've just heard him speak, I'm going to give you the data on the genes in what did he say, one day.
Right. So let's say you have all of these. Okay. Let's say you have all of these genetic perturbations that you can find out, and you can find all the driver mutations, and there's still quite a few passenger mutations. So, so identify them. You'd have to find the targeted medicine for each one of these. And the problem is that, like viruses, tumors evolve very quickly because you have these destabilized genomes in which all the breaks kind of go. And so the more broken these tumors are. I mean, if you look at most pancreatic tumors, it's like a bomb went off in there, the genetic mutations in there. And so I worry that it's going to be very, very difficult if we're getting at the cancers too late. Now, if we get cancers earlier, if we can find biomarkers, the markers of these little warning beacons of pre-neoplastic lesions or very, very early disease, then maybe this targeted approach will bear fruit.
So can you envision a time, maybe it's 20, 30, 40 years from now, in which you'll have hundreds of cancer gene targets and hundreds of specific drugs against them and that will just match the patient to the genetic abnormality? Can you conceive of that?
You know, I can't really even conceive of what I'm doing next week. So,
okay.
So let's leave it. I'm optimistic.
Okay. Frank Braun.
Yeah, I'm a writer for Brown Journal of World Affairs. In relation to this question of collaboration, isn't this situation ripe for a company like Google? In fact, I know they're starting a company called Calico. I mean, analysis and collaboration of big data. I mean, is that?
So I've already mentioned my grand rounds, and my grand rounds was making the case that Google was epidemiology. It was the greatest example of epidemiology because what it was a frictionless one, because there was no barrier to entry and it was just a tremendous amount of data. And in fact, they have used Google to identify flu outbreaks before it's happened, and they're probably going to do a similar approach with Calico. So yeah, I think that the beautiful thing about the sort of creative destruction, I know Israel had mentioned that phrase before, is that you don't know where the next thing is coming from, the great sort of, because it, by its very nature, by its definition, it does explode your understanding of what the ground looks like. And so I hope so, yes.
Let's go over on this side.
Identify
yourself.
I'm Betty Grizzle. I work for Department of Interior, currently furloughed. Hi. You haven't heard the news.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. I actually just also finished a clinical research degree here at UCSD, and that was eye-opening for me coming from a different field. But this issue of collaboration doesn't just happen in medicine. It happens in my agency and other agencies as well. I think it's pervasive. But my question to you is more about prevention and how you see the collaboration working to solve the prevention gap, I would call it that.
Yeah, this is the great $64 question. I say $64 question because that's about what we spend on cancer prevention. If you look at the current budget, and I hate to do things as obvious as this because the rubrics don't break down neatly, but by the NCI's own estimate, we spend about 7% on just prevention. Now, they used to break it down differently and stopped doing the breakdown, which included cancer control, which is a huge part of identifying cancer, and keeping tabs of it. For the most part, if you look at where we have made strides in every other public health concern, it's through preemption, which is a different nuance with prevention, where we go in there and we intervene early in the disease process. So this is really important to me, and I think it's a great question. If you think about heart disease, no one thinks about heart disease as you go to a golf course and you drop dead of a heart attack and then the doctor says, oh, look, you just had heart disease. It's a long process, and we understand that. And we've understood that since the 1950s. And what we do is, fortunately, we have good markers for identifying a progression. But 50 years ago, we didn't know that those markers were as in sync with the outcome as we do now. But so high cholesterol, hypertension, C-reactive protein, inflammatory, other indicators. And what we do is we treat those things. And we treat them ahead of time because we identify the precursor as essentially a disease state. Now, we don't do that with cancer. We still have a culture, a mindset, if you will, that says cancer begins at the diagnosis. We know it's not true. We know it's not true intellectually and scientifically, but that's where the whole clock starts with survival. It's where the drug intervention part of the issue starts. And we really do think of, and so there's no effort to really identify the sort of disease state, even though we know intellectually, scientifically, that in many cases this is a process that's sometimes years or decades underway. And so I think fundamentally we have to attack on prevention, behavior changes, anti-smoking campaigns. We have to start thinking about preemption, about if we're going to have this sort of chronic disease intervention, I think we're going to have to start to think about how we approach that. So great question.
Kerry.
Yes, Gary Dance.
Yes.
I'm an engineer by training, but I've spent the last 12 years funding biotech.
Yeah.
And I can say to the last part of your slide, urgency.
Yeah.
We need some real urgency in this system. Right now, you're stuck in a system where, all right, we got a new drug or we got a new pathway, let's go try it. It takes you years just to get everything in place. Then you do one trial. You might spend 3 to 5 years. You get to the end. Gee, it didn't work.
Right.
Oh, but if we'd have just done this or that, we need to start moving more to translational medicine, which everybody talks about, but you can count on one hand the amount of real translational medicine going on in this town, which is at a forefront. We've got to get doctors like Ivor to say, look, I've got a patient, and that's what happened with your patients there. You had a bunch of kids, and somebody tried them, and work to start trying. You'll find patients are very happy to do it, get in translational, try different things. But our system is structured, oh, no, you can't do that. Oh, the IRB will worry about it. The FDA won't allow it. In fact, you can. If you're doctors, you can do it. We need more people to start trying these because the complexity of what you're dealing with is so bad that I don't care how much you know about pathways and everything, until you go into real humans, you don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
Okay, we have to wrap up. I just want to end by saying, Cliff, when I look back at the history of all this, in the first 50 years, the number one cause of mortality was infectious disease. People died of tuberculosis, syphilis, pneumonia, whatever. Then it was cardiovascular disease. It's no longer the major cause of death. Now it's cancer. Do you not see over the next 50 years that cancer will not be the major cause of death?
Well, let's say I hope so.
So you're optimistic.
Sure.
You're more optimistic than pessimistic.
Yeah, I'm always more optimistic than
That's
pessimistic.
That's right. Glasses half
full.
Well, I even though I read the book, the entire book, and I walked away saying, oh, I don't know, did he just get it right? I think there's more in common that we have than differences. So thank you very much, Cliff.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.